This is The Record. I'm Ross Reynolds. Why is it that the rich are reaping the benefits of economic prosperity while the rest of us are not? Well, Robert Reich has been working on that question for most of his life. Robert Reich was the Secretary of Labor under the Clinton administration. And just as fellow Clinton administration member Al Gore has become the voice of conscience on climate change, Robert Reich has become the voice of conscience on economic inequality. He's even got his own version of An Inconvenient Truth, the award-winning documentary called Inequality for All. Reich is an economist and a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. He says improvements in the economy do not mean that the average worker is doing better.
Even though we are in an economic recovery, we see that the median household income continues to drop if you adjust it for real purchasing power, real inflation. The typical household today is about 8% below in terms of income what it was at in 2007. In fact, it's even poorer than it was in the late 1990s. So this economy is not working for the average person. It's certainly not working for the poor. The only people it seems to be working for are people who are quite rich.
Is the economy a zero-sum game? If some do very well, does that mean the rest of us have less?
No, it should not be a zero-sum game. In fact, for the first 30 years after the Second World War, everybody did better. The rich did better. Everybody else did better. The economy grew. That growth created a kind of a positive sum outcome, almost a virtuous cycle, in which as the middle class grew, the middle class had more purchasing power to turn around and buy more. And when I say buy more, I don't mean just more stuff. I mean there was more purchasing of education, of public health, of all kinds of things that both individuals and also a government that has more tax payments because more people are doing well could also undertake. But late in the 1970s, something began to change. Partly because of globalization, partly because of technological changes that displaced a lot of workers, that meant that there was a downward pressure on wages. Labor unions began to unravel. We saw that across the economy, people began working harder but getting less, at least the typical people and certainly the people under them.
You're listening to Robert Reich. If that voice is familiar, you might remember him from his commentaries on Marketplace, also his work as Secretary of Labor. Now, Seattle recently passed a $15 an hour minimum wage, making it the highest minimum wage in the nation. And some believe that is an effective way to reduce economic inequality. What do you think?
Yes, I'm in that camp. I think Seattle did exactly the right thing. Some economists worry that if you raise the minimum wage, you're going to price a lot of people out of their jobs. But actually, what we've found over the years is that an increase such as Seattle made into law actually puts more money into the pockets of people who are going to spend it all. And that has a multiplier effect in the economy. When people spend that money, more jobs are created. And when more jobs are created, more people have money to spend.
But can you reduce inequality at the local level? If someone's running a store in Seattle and across the street, someone in Renton is running a store and they're not under the requirement that they pay $15 an hour as a minimum wage, don't we have a problem?
Not really. I mean, most of what people buy in a local economy is local. It's local services, retail, restaurant, hotel, hospital, childcare, elder care, and all of those local services are protected from both global competition. Many of them are also, most of them are protected from technological change and technological displacement. I mean, after all, somebody's got to be there to provide an in-person service. And that means that those jobs really can, the wages can be raised. Those jobs and those firms are mostly in quite a bit of competition with others. So they're not going to immediately pass those costs on to consumers. They are more likely to take the money out of profits. And if you're talking about big chains and big hospitals and big big box retailers, their profits are already very, very high. You know, that seems to me, in terms of any issue and any theory of social justice and economic growth, that it's appropriate that a lot of those profits, or at least some of the profits, start going to workers.
That may be true for larger businesses, but we heard from small immigrant-run businesses lobbying against $15 an hour as a minimum wage. They said this will crush them.
Well, I can understand their fears, but actually what they're not taking account of is all of the additional consumers that they will have. We've had a number of studies. In fact, a group of economists here at Berkeley looked at areas where you had really two minimum wages, a city or a metropolitan area that straddled a state that had decided to have a higher minimum wage, or a city that had a higher minimum wage than the federal minimum, and the other part of that metropolitan area that had a lower federal minimum wage, to see whether there was any difference in local businesses in terms of how much they sold or how they did. What was found is that businesses with a higher minimum wages actually did better. Why is that? Well, partly because more people had more money to spend, and they spent it in those areas, in the metropolitan area, but also because those businesses had more people to choose from. The higher minimum wage brought into the labor market more people who were interested in working, who would not have been interested if the minimum wage had been lower. And therefore, there was less turnover. Those businesses found that their actual labor costs, including recruitment and retraining, were less.
Robert Reich, can we be sure that this minimum wage of $15 an hour will be entirely beneficial? I've talked to other economists who basically agree with you on inequality, who say that increasing the minimum wage so much in Seattle presents a really uncertain future, and they're really not clear on what's going to happen, and they're curious about it. Can we be certain that it's going to work the way you say it will here?
Well, nobody's ever certain about anything, but the minimum wage increase in Seattle is not happening all at once. If it were happening all at once, there might be some real adjustment costs. Small businesses might be really hurt. All of the benefits might be coming too late. But it is, it's being put into effect over a number of years. And that gives Seattle enough time to see how it's working for a lot of small businesses to make the adjustments, for a lot of people to get the benefits of those minimum wages, and again, use them to buy more and create more businesses and more business in Seattle. So I think the chances are pretty good that it's going to work quite well. But let me just say one other thing, Ross, and that is that it's not just the minimum wage that is an answer to widening inequality. A lot of other things have to be done. I think something called the Earned Income Tax Credit, which is a wage subsidy for low-income people, has got to be expanded and extended up into the middle class. I think our educational systems, particularly early childhood education, have to be improved. We've got to tax the wealthy in order to have the money to pour into the quality of education that many of our poor and middle-class kids need if they're going to succeed in this new world economy.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because that was the next topic I wanted to talk about. There are certainly many factors in creating inequality. Washington State is known as having one of the most regressive tax systems in the country. Low-income people pay a much higher percentage of their income in taxes than high-income people. How important is that in maintaining the increasing inequality we've seen in recent decades?
Well, it is an important factor, and I, you know, far be it from me to intrude on what people in Washington State want to do, but it would seem to me that you want a tax system that is not regressive, that doesn't take a higher percentage of the typical dollar of the lower income person, but takes a higher percentage of the typical dollar of the higher income person. A state that is very dependent on sales taxes, for example, is almost invariably having a regressive effect on its labor market. It's hurting the poor more than the rich.
Washington voters a few years ago had a chance to vote on an income tax for millionaires. We don't have an income tax, but this would just have been for millionaires, and it got voted down pretty decisively. What's going on here when the public is resisting higher taxes on the rich, and what impact does that have on inequality?
Well, there are two things that are going on. One, some people just worry that if higher taxes are installed for the rich, it'll just be the beginning of a slippery slope. The higher taxes are going to eventually move downward to the middle class, then downward to the lower middle class, the working class, and also to the poor. There's no evidence that that's the case, but it's easy to create that kind of fear, particularly if the second condition holds, and that is that a lot of very wealthy people and also corporations spend a lot on politics. They, in many, many ways, create campaigns that deter the kind of policies that we're talking about, whether we're talking about raising taxes on the rich or improving education in terms of spending more or improving and widening the earned income tax credit. Unfortunately, there are some wealthy people and some big corporations that are willing to spend a lot of money to prevent voters from doing those things and actually end up distorting the message, end up distorting the truth.
Robert Reich, Secretary of Labor under Bill Clinton. The documentary about him, Inequality for All, is available on DVD and through streaming services if you'd like to hear more from him. This is The Record on KUOW.